This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Rage, a Joe Ledger and Rogue Team International novel by Jonathan Mayberry. Read for you by Ray Porter. Aleppo, Syria, Part 1. My first wish is to see this plague of mankind, war, banished from the earth. George Washington. Chapter 1. If the world is on all four wheels and nothing is burning, you'll never hear from guys like me. But let's face it, when's the last time that was true? Chapter 2. Al Manzel Cafe, Zohar ibn Abi Solma Street, Aleppo, Syria. So, they dragged me out of the back of an Iveco LMV that smelled of dog piss and human blood. Even with a black bag over my head, my eyes were watering. Can't begin to imagine how the four soldiers who nabbed me dealt with it. Many psychopaths don't care about smelly cars. Then again, maybe they do. Psychologically speaking, I'm a bit of a freak show myself, and it bothered me. Be kind of funny if I was crazier than a bunch of henchmen working for President Assad. Musings of a guy about to be tortured and killed. My hands were zip-cuffed behind my back. The beating they gave me was, I can assume, just a sort of greeting? Welcome to Syria, that kind of thing. I heard them open a heavy door and then heard it slam shut behind. Heavy locks and the dull thud of a crossbar being dropped into place. I stumbled along with two of them holding me under the armpits, counting my steps, numbering the hallways and turns. Down one flight, two, three, deep under somewhere. The place smelled a lot better than the vehicle except for one place where there was a heavy, rancid stink. It wasn't a dead smell, not exactly, not like a corpse. It was more of a gangrene stench, and I wondered if maybe some injured prisoner was locked up, rotting in the fetid darkness. But we moved on, and soon I could smell more wholesome things. Wheat, flour, lentils, figs, and coffee. A lot of coffee. Smelled good, and I could use a cup and a nice pastry. Maybe a namura with some nuts on top? Yum. Another door opened. Creaky hinges. Dahunak, said a voice. Male, middle-aged, and authoritative, speaking Syrian Arabic. Defi akursi. They did as they were told and put me in a chair. There was a whisk of a knife to remove the plastic cuffs, and then a metallic clink as steel cuffs were snapped too tightly around my wrists. Threaded through the back slats of the chair. They were being very careful. Then the same voice said, Khalil Gata. Take off the hood. Which they did. In any hostage situation, it is generally not a good sign when they let you see their faces. It does not, as the saying goes, bode well. One is expected to be filled with a reasonable amount of dread. No problem, then. I was sweating heavy-caliber bullets, and I'm pretty sure my sphincter was never going to unclench. Ever. Even if I lived through this. I blinked my eyes clear. They had me in a small storeroom that was stripped of everything except shelves, the chair on which I sat, and a wooden table on which were the kind of items you never want to see outside of a horror movie. They were laid out to impress me, from the scalpels all the way to the bone saw. Eloquent. And, weirdly, a bottle of Diet Coke. The middle-aged man stood with his back to me. He was average height, slim, wore khakis and a white shirt. I watched him remove a blue sports coat, shake some cellar dust from it, and hand it to a guard. His shoes were highly polished, and his wristwatch was expensive, a Tag Heuer Monaco that had to run 40 grand. A lot of watch for a guy who was supposed to be a civil servant, but let's face it, corruption came with perks. Kind of the point. The four men who brought me here were dressed in clothes so obviously nondescript they might as well have worn uniforms. Jeans, dress shirts, sneakers. They moved like military, so they weren't fooling anyone. The middle-aged guy spent a few moments arranging the instruments on the table, straightening them, picking one or another up to examine as if they were items at a juried craft fair and he was a discerning buyer. It was all a bit of theater, psychodrama to unnerve whoever might be cuffed to that chair. I doubted I was the first person to attend this show. Turn around. I willed him to get on with it. Turn around and let me see those baby blue eyes. Hoping they would be blue eyes. Just like I was hoping there would be a white streak in his mustache, if in fact he had a mustache. Turn around, bright eyes. And now I had the damn Bonnie Tyler song playing in my head. He turned. I almost smiled. He had the biggest, brightest, sunniest blue eyes you'd ever want to see in the face of a practiced torturer and state-sponsored terrorist. And the white streak? Yep. Just under his left nostril. Kasim Almasi. And he held a slender boning knife the way a conductor holds a baton, ready to make music.
"We were very clear," he said, still speaking in Arabic. "They were to send no one, no police, no military."
"That's not what I am," I said in the same language. I tweaked it with a vaguely Eastern European accent.
"My men said you moved like a soldier. You spotted them following you, tried several very professional methods to evade pursuit, and had an unregistered disposable phone."
"Not a soldier," I repeated. "I'm private security."
"Security for whom?" asked Almasi. "We were very specific when we spoke to her father."
"I know, but I'm not working for Mr. Jacobson." He touched the point of the boning knife low so that it rested very lightly on my crotch.
"Then who are you working for?"
I smiled.
"I work for Overligan Kjemi."
That hung in the air for a moment. Overligan Kjemi was the Norwegian company that made industrial pesticides and agricultural antifungals. Oliver Jacobson was a journalist who'd infiltrated the company to gather irrefutable proof that a new generation of weaponized mycotoxins were being developed for sale to the Syrian government. These bioweapons caused immediate anaphylaxis. Unlike sarin gas, which was President Assad's favorite toy for urban pacification, these fungi were specifically designed to look like a natural mutation. Better murder through chemistry. Jacobson got out with a lot of information, enough to put the entire company out of business and its executives in jail. It would also get the United Nations to stop fucking around and step in to take Assad down. Assad's spies got wind of it almost too late. They tried to pick up Jacobson, missed him by 3 minutes, and kidnapped his only daughter, Astrid, instead. The deal was simple. Jacobson had to turn himself and all of his research in to Assad's goons. That included email passwords and all other access that would prove that he had no copies and had sent no story to his news service. Fail to do so, and Astrid would be gang-raped, tortured, and dismembered, all of which would be recorded on high-def video for her father to watch. The boning knife pressed down.
"Why would Overligan Kjemi send a field agent?" asked Almasi. "We are handling it. Don't they trust us?"
He contrived to look shocked and hurt. I shrugged.
"Because they don't trust anyone, would you?"
Almasi smiled.
"And what is your brief?"
"To find where the girl's being held to make sure she's alive."
"And what does her being alive matter to you?"
"Because her father hasn't turned himself in yet," I said, "and there's no chance at all he'd do so without proof of life. He's going to need that. I mean, come on, we all know he's a dead man as soon as this deal closes. There's no reason to keep him alive, and a lot of good reasons to cut his throat as soon as you have his files. Knowing he's walking into a death trap, he's got to believe his sacrifice will be worth it. So,
Yeah, he's going to want to see her alive. He's probably going to push to see her in person before he gives you the last passwords. My boss has sent me to make sure your team wasn't going to screw the pooch.
He considered that for a moment, then stepped back. He didn't put the knife down. Bottom line here, I said, is that if this hits a speed bump, the guy who signs my paycheck goes away for life. Our whole company goes belly up, and you boys will need another group of mad scientists to cook up your next batch of party favors.
Almasi turned and spoke to one of his men in rapid-fire Circassian, which is a language used in some villages in the Aleppo suburbs. I didn't understand a word of it. Not one of my languages. Then Almasi held a cell phone out to me. A man was yelling something harsh, but clearly not into the phone. Then a woman's voice, young and frightened, pleaded for help in Norwegian. I'd heard tapes of Astrid Jacobson. This was her. There was some yelling, and then Astrid screamed in serious pain. Almasi ended the call. The sound of the screams seemed to hang in the air for a moment, faint, but definitely not an echo from the call. I heard the scream wind down and disintegrate into weeping. Astrid was here. I smiled. Thanks, I said. Almasi raised the boning knife.
Whoa, I yelped. What gives?
He approached slowly.
I want you to give a message to your employers, he said, still smiling. I want you to explain that sending you was clumsy and stupid, and that we will not tolerate any further.
There was a click and a rattle, and then a metallic click-clack. It stopped him, and his eyes flicked down to the floor. The guards looked down, too. My handcuffs lay there.
Fuck it, I was a cop and then a spec ops shooter for a bunch of years. If I couldn't get out of a pair of handcuffs, then I wasn't even trying.
I smiled and said,
oops.
Chapter 3 Almanzel Cafe, Zor bin Abisolma Street, Aleppo, Syria. As I came up off the chair, I kicked it backward with my heel so that it hit one of the two guards on my right. Used the same foot to kick the kneecap loose on the front guard on my left, and stepped into Almasi and punched him in the throat. Not a killing blow, but hard enough. He gagged and stumbled back. I snatched the boning knife from his hand, pivoted, and stabbed it into the eye socket of the first guard to reach for me. Then I grabbed a meat cleaver and a big butcher knife from the table. They had guns, but they'd been slung. I'd been a beaten, cuffed prisoner, and there were five of them. In their minds, I was just a desperate prisoner making a last, desperate attempt to escape. I gave them no time at all to correct their mistake. The guy with the broken knee tried to grab me as he fell, but I kneed him in the face and buried the cleaver in the shoulder of the man behind him. The heavy blade chunked through meat and bone, and blood shot all the way to the ceiling. I whirled toward the fourth man, the one I'd kicked the chair at. He was bringing his weapon up, but I was 3 feet away, and I had a blade. They don't call it a butcher knife for nothing. As he fell with nothing but a string of gristle keeping his head on, I turned and drove the knife between the shoulder blades of the guy with the broken knee. Then I kicked Almasi in the balls, mostly because I could. Took a short, heavy knife from the table and cut the throats of every man who was screaming. Total elapsed time? Maybe 3 seconds. You don't want fights to last longer than that. Almasi was trying to breathe and trying to crawl, failing at both. His face was an awful shade of mauve. I used to have a car that color. It was a worthless piece of shit, too. I tapped a mole on my tragus, the little flap of skin and cartilage on the outer ear, and said, "You get all that?"
"Roger that, outlaw," said a voice in my ear. "We have a medical team en route, ETA 4 minutes. Havoc team is 6 blocks out.
Tell Havoc to close on my location, but not to enter until I give the word."
"Copy that. I have 4 pigeon drones in the air, running thermals. Ground floor has 1 signature and a heat bloom consistent with a bakery oven. According to your RFID chip, you're on the bottom of 3 subfloors, picking up multiple signatures on the top floor. Count 16 signatures. Count 20 hostiles on sub 1, but scans can't read any farther down."
"Swell," I said. "Make sure Havoc brings their toys." A deep voice said, "We brought all the toys, outlaw."
Nice to know that my team was on the same channel and that the building structure wasn't blocking anyone from the party.
That deep voice belonged to Bradley Sims, known as Top to everyone, but his combat call sign was Pappy, because he was the oldest field operator anyone knew. Looking at 50, but not where it showed. Other kids in the playground are Republican Guard in civilian clothes, I said, heavily armed.
Sucks to be them, then,
said another voice, younger with a Southern California surfer drawl. Harvey Rabbit. Sadly, that was his actual name. We called him Bunny in every situation, other than when we were out on a gig. His combat call sign was Donnie Darko. I took the weapons away from the soldiers, checked the magazines on a Makarov PM and tucked it in the back of my belt, and pocketed 4 spare mags. Took the heavier Browning high power and slid it between belt buckle and belly. Only 3 magazines for that, but they held 13 rounds each, as opposed to 8-round mags for the Russian gun. The long guns were AK-104s with 30-round mags. I had no idea how many more of Almasi's goons were in the building. Listening at the door got me an earful of silence. Apparently no one comes to investigate screams in a place like this. I looked down at Almasi. That was going to be unfortunate for him. Chapter 4 Almanzel Cafe, Zohar ibn Abi Sulma Street, Aleppo, Syria. Almasi was chatty. Might have been a revelation for him, if he appreciated the irony. Torturers tend to think that they could endure the kinds of physical horrors they inflict. I mean, sure, deep down they know they can't, but projecting the air of confidence goes with the job. When it comes right down to the point where scrotum and knife blade are introduced, they're not at all interested in you swiping left. Or right. I didn't have to draw a single drop of blood before he told me every goddamn thing I wanted to know. And some stuff I didn't want to know. Maybe he thought if he kept telling me stuff, I wouldn't kill him. Hope springs eternal. Arteries do not. I patted his twitching corpse down and took a cell phone. The fact that it was password protected didn't mean a damn thing to me because Bug and his team laugh at that kind of security. Once I got out of here and plugged the cell into a mind reader uplink, the encryption would get its ass kicked. I left the room and did a quick check on the hallway. Clear. Took a moment to orient myself. From what I remembered of the route here, they'd brought me in from my right. The scream I'd heard was to my left. Not close, but close enough to have been heard through closed doors. I tucked the stock of the AK-104 into my shoulder and went hunting. Running quickly, taking a lot of small steps instead of big ones in order to maintain contact with the ground for shooting stability. The basement was cool and clammy, but there was a definite smell of baking bread. Faint, though, probably ground level. Either a restaurant or cafe used as a front for dirty work like this. Oliver Jacobson was semi-blackmailing us. He had the data on Assad and the chemical company, but he wouldn't give it to us or anyone as long as Astrid was in danger. Couldn't entirely blame him. I'm coming, I mentally promised the young woman. She was 17, a smart, pretty teenager who expected to grow up and have a life unpolluted by monsters. The kind of person who stopped believing in monsters in her closet or under the bed long ago. Sad truth was that there were much worse monsters in the real world. Some of them ran corporations like Overleague and Kiemi. Some were immoral psychopaths like Almasi and his goon squad. And some were heads of state. Some monsters, though, were on her side. I moved through the shadows. The hall ended in a T-juncture. The left-hand side ran 40 feet and ended in a row of pallets stacked high with sacks of flour and large tins of olive oil. The right side led to a single door 50 feet in. There were 2 guards in front of it, both with rifles. As I knelt at the corner, I could hear them talking about last night's football match. Iran lost to Japan by a single goal. The guard on the left won 5,000 pounds. The Syrian pound is for shit, so that was about 10 American dollars. Seemed to matter a lot to him, and he thought the referee was on the pad. The other guy was nodding the way people do when they disagree, but everyone's holding rifles. I had one, too. I stepped into the hallway and shot them both. Then I ran like a son of a bitch and emptied the rest of the magazine into the door lock, blowing it apart. There was a burst of automatic gunfire from inside, and I shifted sideways to avoid lead and splinters. The angle of the shots told me a lot, hopefully enough. I dropped the rifle, drew the Browning, and went in low and fast, pivoting and squatting as I went through the door, gun in both hands. There were two men in there. Both had rifles. They stood behind a slim blonde with a torn blouse and blood on her face. They fired chest high, aiming where they assumed I'd be. I fired at where they actually were. The 9mm rounds punched through their faces and blew out the backs of their heads. I spun to make sure there was no one behind the door. There wasn't. Astrid Jacobson screamed at the top of her lungs. Of course she did. I put a finger to my lips.
My name is Colonel Joe Ledger. I'm a friend of your father. We're here to get you out.
Astrid stopped screaming, gaped for a moment, then whispered,
Papa?
He's waiting for you at a safe house, I told her. We'll take you to him.
She looked past me to see who we was. I winked, tapped my earbud, and said,
Package secure, need exfil now. Kick the doors and make some noise. The only friendly is with me. Designate all others as hostile. Go weapons hot.
I wanted to say something like, cry havoc and let slip the dogs of war, but you have to read the room. I mean, I'd already winked, and that was pretty corny. Upstairs, I heard an alarm go off. I heard explosions as doors blew inward, then gunfire echoed through the dusty halls. Chapter 5 Al-Manzil Cafe, Zor ibn Abi Solma Street, Aleppo, Syria. It got real damn loud. Alarms began blaring as if anyone needed proof that bad shit was happening. I heard doors bang open and men yelling. There was the rattle of automatic gunfire upstairs and booted feet pounding down concrete stairs.
Get behind this wall and stay down until I tell you to move, I ordered.
Astrid paused for a long moment, trying to shift gears and grinding the clutch.
Do exactly as I say, and we will get out of this. Now get down.
She did. Smoke was funneling along the hall, driven by the pressure of movement and the force waves of the breaching explosions from upstairs. I could see shapes moving toward me, but there is a moment in these kinds of situations where you can't tell if it's the cavalry riding to the rescue or bad guys coming to kill you. I tapped my earbud. Havoc actual to Havoc team, I growled. What's your location?
Two floors up, outlaw, came the reply from Pappy. Meeting heavy resistance.
Is there anyone from Havoc team in sub-basement two?
Negative, outlaw, we're all up here.
Very well, I said, unhappy with that news. Coming your way, Havoc actual plus one. We'll let you know when we reach the ground floor. The hallway bent ahead and then stretched into darkness, punctuated by the meager yellow light of low-wattage bulbs in wire cages mounted on the walls. There were doors on both sides of the hall, which is always a scary thing. You never know who is going to come out of them, and with Astrid behind me, I couldn't safely check and clear each one. That meant I could not guarantee the protection I'd promised. I gave her some quick instructions about how to move with me and not hamper what I do. We moved. I followed the barrel of my gun, but every dozen steps I turned and brought it up again as I scanned behind us, dipping the barrel each time to prevent it hitting a wall or other obstruction. Rinse, repeat. It was a long hallway, but it matched pretty well to the distances I'd calculated when they were bringing me in. If I was right, there would be a right turn ahead and then some stairs. The toughest part in a recovery operation of this kind is the speculation about what, or more to the point, who might be behind some of those closed doors. Could be a couple of squads of Assad soldiers polishing their bullets. We moved as fast as we could. At the end of the hall, I stopped because there was a side corridor going off to my left that I hadn't been aware of on the way here. Or maybe I had. I'd smelled something rancid for a moment on the way in. I'd assumed it was a prisoner in a cell, dying or maybe long dead. We crouched near the mouth of the corridor because I could hear voices talking excitedly, and I caught snatches of what they were saying, demanding answers to what was happening upstairs, demanding protection. But I also caught individual words like samples and evacuation. I gestured for Astrid to be still and silent. She nodded, but her face was filled with terror. I pivoted on the balls of my feet and did a quick look around the corner, then leaned out to look in through an open door. I couldn't see much, but what I did glimpse looked like a laboratory. There were tables covered with high-end laptops and a pretty elaborate industrial chemistry setup. A guard stood outside, turned away from us, looking into the room, jabbering on his cell phone, demanding to speak to the lieutenant. I wondered if that lieutenant had met my friends upstairs, because if he had, then Soldier Boy here was going to need a really good calling plan to reach him in the afterlife. I really wanted to have a look inside that lab. Its presence here, so close to where Almasi had brought Astrid, seemed suggestive. So I pulled back and leaned very close to the girl. "Listen to me," I said, speaking very quietly instead of whispering, because the sibilance of whispers carry farther. "There is a guard around the corner, and I need to deal with him. Do you understand what that means? Just nod." Her eyes were huge and filled with the tears of fear and horror, and she began to say something but stopped herself. She was impressing the hell out of me. She nodded. "I need you to stay right here. Do not move. Do not follow me. I'll be back very quickly. Nod if you understand." She did. I gave her the patented Joe Ledger smile, the one that crinkles the corners of my eyes and looks like a poster for good dental hygiene. My stolen weapons had no sound suppressors, which left me with a fuck it approach. So I wheeled around the corner and ran straight at the guard, opening up with the rifle, with the selector set to 2-round bursts. The bullets hit him center mass and blew a big hole through his spine and heart. He fell and I was through the door, taking in everything in a split part of a second. There were 5 long tables filled with the lab equipment. 6 tall glass tanks were arranged almost like a brewery, with pipes and hoses going everywhere. Some of those hoses were socketed into the walls of 3 small cells built into the right-hand wall, each with glass walls and heavily locked doors. Through the glass I could see figures, prisoners or test subjects or both. Some kind of gas or vapor was hissing into the tanks. The prisoners saw it and freaked out, beating with bloodied fists to try and get out. Each prisoner's face was twisted into a mask of terror and fury. There were biohazard symbols stenciled on everything. There were 5 people in white lab coats and 4 uniformed guards with rifles. They were all frozen in a microsecond of shock, the lab geeks stuffing papers into leather cases, the guards realizing that I had my gun leveled and theirs were still slung. The frozen moment burst apart. The guards raised their weapons fast, but then hesitated because the glass tanks were behind me. I could see the indecision ignite in their eyes. I did not hesitate and opened up on them, hosing them with the AK-104. Their indecision was fatal. But as they fell, 2 of them jerked fingers on their triggers and bullets hammered into the scientists, who went spinning away, red poppies blooming on their white lab coats. And some of their wild rounds hit the lab equipment. I emptied an entire magazine, spraying everyone I could hit. In the space of 2 seconds, the room went from urgent uncertainty into a madhouse of exploding glass and metal. Laptops erupted in showers of sparks, rounds ricocheted off the machinery and walls and the curved faces of the tubes. 2 of my bullets exploded the glass on one of the holding cells, releasing a swarm of flies, a much greater stink of living rot, and a prisoner who, insane with pain or fear or outrage, grabbed one of the soldiers and dragged him over the jagged teeth of the broken pane. The prisoner began punching the soldier with both fists, screaming incoherently, brutalizing a man who was probably already dead. I shot the rest of the scientists, but saw that the guard's wild rounds had driven big cracks into one of the tubes. I said, "Fuck this," and got the hell out of there. Maybe I did some good by ruining this little mad science project, or maybe I made a big goddamn mistake. Couldn't unring that bell, though, so I hooked Astrid under an arm, hauled her to her feet, and we ran. Behind me I heard terrible screams and something that was so weird and out of place that it chilled me to the bone. Laughter. High, shrill, twisted, and filled with a madness beyond words. Chapter 6. Almanzel Cafe, Zor Ibn Abi Solma Street, Aleppo, Syria. We ran down the hall, wheeled around, and saw the steps at the end of another short corridor. There were two closed doors, one on either side, and the sounds of a fierce gunfight rolling down the stairs.
"Get behind me," I ordered. "Keep your hand on my back."
Before we got five steps, one of the doors opened and four men erupted from the room, firing as soon as they saw us, filling the air with hot lead, stone splinters, and choking dust. I killed the first shooter, and his next rounds hit the floor as he fell. Another man tripped over him and went down, so I ignored him for a moment and killed the two men behind him. Then I crouched and put three rounds center mass as the fallen man struggled to his feet. They were shooting through the dust and smoke that swirled around them. I was hunkered down in the shadows. They missed. I didn't. Then I was up, swapping magazines, moving forward into the gloom, firing as more people came out of the other room. Two people in civilian clothes, both with handguns, fell, one with a scream and the other with a curse. I ran along the hall to the two doorways, saw that they were empty, then moved back to the dead men and took as many fresh magazines as I could cram into my pockets. I did fast pat-downs in the hope they were wearing body armor under their clothes. Would have been nice to have some for Astrid and me, but they had nothing. Astrid was completely terrified, and her body shook as if this was all happening in an industrial freezer. There was a jumpy quality to her eyes, but she wasn't crying. She wasn't being hysterical. That spoke to a deep core of strength beneath the youth and the shock. I've seen adults, including some people who you'd expect to be towers of strength, crumble in situations less horrific than this one. "Stay behind me," I ordered. We moved back to the T-junction and then along the corridors back to where I'd left Almasi. As we passed the open doorway, she gave a small cry. "Don't look," I said. But Astrid stepped into the room and stood over Almasi for a moment. Then she spat into his dead face. As she turned, I saw a sneer of contempt that was much more refined, controlled. It was the contempt of someone in possession of her emotions rather than a hysterical teen, and I knew that if I could get her out of this, she would be well. There was another explosion upstairs, and the alarm abruptly cut out. I grinned. "Let's go," I said. "Put your hand on my back, keep it there no matter what happens. Don't hold on to my belt. Do you understand?" She nodded, but I made her say it out loud. She did. We ran along the hall, retracing the pattern of turns I logged while being dragged to the interrogation room, found the steps, and we went up. The second floor had only two of Assad's soldiers, both dressed as civilians, neither wearing body armor. Sucked to be them. One of them got off a lucky shot as he went down, and the round hit my rifle and tore it out of my hands. My fingers went numb, and the strap damn near tore my arm out of the socket. My shot caught him in the same instant, though, and it tore a red hole in his belly. With hands that felt like nerveless balloons, I drew the handgun and parked another round in his forehead. Astrid was sobbing now, small, choked sobs that sounded like they hurt, tearing themselves out of her chest. I called her name, told her to stay with me, and she did. She was scared, but she was tough. I tapped the earbud again. "Havoc Actual to Havoc Team, be advised I am in the stairwell with the package. How much shit are we about to step into?" There was a flurry of gunfire, and then a woman's voice. "Havoc Actual," said Mother Mercy. "Come ahead, but stay low." She spoke with a terse Mauritanian accent. With Astrid still touching my back, we climbed the last few steps and then entered one of the anterooms of hell. Or maybe a slaughterhouse. There were bodies everywhere. Three men came hurrying down a flight of steps, yelling as they opened up with Kalashnikovs. Mother Mercy fired three shots and they went down. Bang, bang, bang. No fuss, lots of muss, because the rifle blew big red holes in them. Astrid cried out and the hand on my back gripped a sudden fistful of my shirt. "It's okay," I said. "We'll get you out." The soldiers had other plans, though, and there were a lot of them. More of the killers were thundering down the stairs from the second floor, but suddenly a monstrous shape loomed like a giant above me.
"Right here, outlaw," said Donnie Darko, the huge kid from Orange County. He wore loose black clothes, Kevlar chest and limb pads, and a ballistic helmet, and in his hands was an Atchison assault shotgun with a 32-round drum magazine.
The big man opened up and filled the stairwell with death. There were screams, and then bodies tumbled like a pile of dolls at the foot of the stairs. Another knot of them came pounding along the left-hand hall, and I flattened sideways, pushing Astrid behind me and down. As I opened up, I burned a full mag into them. "I'm out," I yelled as the slide locked back, but Donnie Darko handed a pistol to me.
"One up,"
he said, letting me know it was loaded and had one in the chamber. Then he moved past us, heading toward the end of the hall, which was shrouded in smoke.
"Got an Uber coming. Stay on my six."
"Roger that," I said, and moved as he moved.
"Door left,"
he said as he went along the hall, his shotgun barrel swiveling side to side as he passed rooms filled with death.
"Clear. Door right. Clear."
We passed two open doorways through which I could see just how thoroughly Havoc Team had cleared the obstacles.
"Door right,"
said Donnie Darko, but then Pappy stepped out of that room, fitting a new magazine into his weapon. He was a big black man who looked tough enough to eat iron bars with only a little steak sauce. He saw Astrid, saw that she was unharmed, and gave me a nod.
"House clear for a run to the back door," Pappy said. "Mother Mercy's got a shooting blind there."
He fell in behind Astrid, walking backward, pointing his weapon the way we'd come. A figure came out of the smoke behind us, running low and fast.
"Havoc, Havoc," he called in a thick Italian accent. "Friendly coming in."
Then I saw the slim, wiry figure of Jackpot, an empty pouch flapped at his side, which meant he'd been busy laying charges.
"Sta per diventare rumoroso chi,"
he shouted as he raced past. "It's about to get loud in here." Brick dust and gun smoke choked the air, but the clouds were stabbed through with the green laser lights from Pappy and Jackpot's guns as they covered our run. There were dead bodies and expended shell casings everywhere. None of the bodies were dressed like my guys. Suddenly there was a piercing shriek behind us, and a figure burst from the stairwell. He was a civilian, unarmed, covered in blood, and his eyes were filled with madness. I recognized him as the prisoner from downstairs who'd brutalized a guard. Two of Assad's men were on the stairs that led to the second floor, and they suddenly screamed and turned their guns on him as if Havoc Team did not even exist. They fired, but the man was already in the air, slamming into them. The three of them collapsed into a thrashing tangle of screams and blood.
"What the actual fuck?"
said Donnie Darko.
"Move, move, move!"
yelled Pappy.
We moved.
We ran like hell down the corridor. The small, slim figure of Mother Mercy was at the far end, her rifle laid atop a packing crate, and beyond her was an open doorway.
"Shift left,"
she barked, and we did. Astrid flinched as Mother Mercy fired. She seemed to take her time with it, like there wasn't a battle and smoke and everything around us going to shit. There was nothing hurried about her as she aimed, took a breath, exhaled as she fired. Again, and then again. I glanced back and saw the escaped prisoner go flying backwards with his chest blown apart. Then a soldier's head exploded, and then another died with a big red hole in his sternum. 1, 2, 3. Mother Mercy looked for another target, killed it. Another, killed that one too. It was so calm, so cold, that even to me it was eerie. Snipers are a breed apart from other kinds of soldiers, and some of them seem to exist in a type of ethereal other place where time and distance were nothing to them. It was a kind of dark zen, not without its purity, but all the scarier for that. As I guided Astrid toward the door, we edged around Mother Mercy, who turned and gave us a stare as alien as anything I'd ever seen on a human face. She looked Astrid up and down, saw she was uninjured, gave the smallest of nods, then turned and killed another soldier, all in a strange little moment. And, call me crazy, I thought I felt something pass between Mother Mercy and Astrid. A kind of unspoken conversation, a telepathy from one person who had survived being held captive by violent men to another. It was a language I, as a man, would never quite understand, because no matter what they might have done to me, The experience of women in these situations carries with it a more terrible cost. And it made them citizens of some country which men could be aware of, but to which they would never be permitted passage. Some men resent that kind of privacy and intimacy between women, which speaks to a lack of insight and empathy that runs miles deep. "Go," said Mother Mercy, and we went. A voice spoke in my ear as I peered through the doorway to the street. It was Bug, the RTI computer wizard working real-time mission support from the talk. "Havoc team, be advised. There are multiple vehicles converging on your location. Count three. Government, Otokar, Cobra, infantry vehicles. Heat signatures, times 24. These are active military guys. No one's trying to hide anymore. ETA 3 minutes. Get the hell out of there." I looked up the street and saw our own black SUV come screeching to a smoking stop. The driver, a local asset, yelled out the window for us to haul ass. I turned to Astrid and gave her a big white grin. "Time to go home." We ran for the car, with Bunny sweeping the street with his shotgun ready for anything, but seeing nothing. Pappy and Jackpot followed us out, and with me formed a human shield around Astrid. Then Pappy turned and knelt and trained his weapon on the door as he ordered Mother Mercy to fall back. There were two more shots, and then she burst from the building, her rifle held at port arms as she ran for the SUV. Several figures crowded through the doorway, and I was confused, because two of them wore lab coats. Not the ones I'd shot, but other scientists. There must have been a second lab. They screamed and beat at the soldiers who were first to the door, and the whole bunch of them snagged there, fighting so hard to exit that none of them could. It was a vicious damn fight, too. The soldiers seemed absolutely terrified of the scientists, which was the reverse of anything that made sense. Pappy emptied his magazine into them, driving the whole cluster back inside in a cloud of blood. Then he whirled, and Bunny reached out and hauled him inside as the SUV leaped forward. "Havoc team," cried Bug. "You have two Milmi attack helicopters in the air, ETA 2 minutes.
Jesu Christo,"
gasped Jackpot. "Bug," I yelled, "you need to buy us some time." "Working on it, Outlaw," he told me. Bug made sure the traffic lights worked for us, and he turned all of their cell phones and radios into a scrambled mess of static and ear-piercing shrieks. He kicked his way into the onboard computers of the three approaching vehicles and told them to kill the engines. The helicopter engines couldn't be similarly stalled, but Bug took charge of their targeting system, and we heard rockets exploding a few blocks away. "Count two infantry vehicles," Bug said dryly. There was another rolling boom. "My bad, only one." Jackpot took out a small transmitter and began pushing buttons. Behind us, the entire building seemed to leap into the air in a cloud of dense black smoke, veined with Halloween orange and devil red. The SUV raced away like the world was on fire. Astrid pressed herself against me there in the back seat and began to weep uncontrollably. I wrapped my arm around her. Mother Mercy turned from the front passenger seat, placed her hand on the girl's shoulder, and we raced away in silence.
Interlude 1. Area 94, Secure Military Black Site, Triple I, Arizona, 16 months ago. Dr. Rudy Sanchez sat in an uncomfortable metal chair with insufficient padding. Rudy was not as thin as he once was, and the hard, cold metal made his buttocks ache. The room was chilly despite the blistering heat outside. The steel table was bolted to the floor and set with a D-ring mounted on the opposite side. The cup of coffee Rudy had brought with him from the warden's office had grown tepid, and he suspected that the milk had passed its use-by date. He pushed the cup aside, glanced at his watch, spent a few minutes rereading the transcripts of his previous interviews with the prisoner who was being brought up from his cell. For more than 2 years, Rudy Sanchez had come out to this place to try and unlock the mind of a man he believed to be psychotic and one of the most unrepentantly evil men alive. That was saying something, because Rudy had met people who were true monsters, as this man was a monster. He heard the clang of a heavy door being slid back down the hall. The guards were coming with their prisoner. Just the thought of it sickened Rudy. It made him afraid, too, but the dominant reaction was one of deep disgust. Even so, he composed his face and settled against the chair back, crossed his legs, and waited. There was the sound of shoes scuffing on the concrete outside, the scrape of a key as the guard fitted it into the lock, the click of tumblers and the creak of hinges. It called to mind scenes from old black-and-white movies about prisoners in the Tower of London. The door swung outward and four muscular, unsmiling guards escorted a small man into the room. He was thin, but not emaciated. A man worn down to piano wire and petrified wood. The kind of man who would always be made stronger and more dangerous by hardship. Weakness did not seem to belong to this man's physical or psychological makeup. The prisoner shuffled along within the restrictions of the ankle, waist, and wrist chains. He wore a ball gag because he was a biter. His eyes, however, were calm. Rudy once remarked to his wife, Circe, that this prisoner had the calm and almost kind eyes of a country parson. Sometimes eyes were windows to the soul, but with this prisoner, they were pretty bits of polished glass. The guards pushed the man into the only other chair in the room, and two of them stood with drawn batons while the others disconnected the handcuffs and clicked them securely to the sturdy D-ring on the steel table.
"Remove the gag, please," asked Rudy.
They did so.
"Wait outside."
The guards always hesitated on this, never wanting to leave anyone alone with this man. But Dr. Sanchez came armed with all of the authority of Mr. Church, and no one crossed the big man. As always, the shift supervisor touched the butt of his baton to the prisoner's chest and said the same thing he always said.
"Behave."
The degree of threat in that single word was eloquent. Rudy waited until the guards left and the door closed. Not locked, not even fully latched, but closed enough for a private conversation in discreet tones. He allowed the moment to change its frequency, to become calmer, quieter, and thereby more personal. It worked, sometimes, coaxing the prisoner into having a more conversational discourse. At other times, it worked against Rudy, making him feel exposed and vulnerable, despite the fact that he was not the one in chains. He wondered what it would be today.
"Good afternoon, Dr. Sanchez,"
said the prisoner, his manner polite, his voice soft, his eyes filled with the lie of sunshine and smiles. Rudy searched those uninformative parson's eyes, looking for a hint of the truth behind them, trying to catch a glimpse of one of the most dangerous killers alive in a very troubled world. He cleared his throat and tried to sound perfectly normal.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Santoro."
Chapter 7. Arclight Safe House, Undisclosed Location, Aleppo, Syria. Oliver Jacobson held his daughter and she clung to him, both of them sobbing fit to break the world. At the safe house, a medic provided by Arclight checked the young woman out. She gave me a shake and a tiny smile. The girl had been roughed up, but not sexually assaulted. We'd gotten to her in time. It did not give me even a flicker of regret for the damage done to those assholes. There was zero chance she'd ever have been released alive and unmolested. Not one chance. She and her father would have gone into an unmarked grave as soon as the stolen data was turned over. We left them alone in the dining room and Havoc gathered in the kitchen. The safe house custodian was a hatchet-faced woman who looked like she ate babies, but she gave me a hug and a kiss on the cheek. She, like the medic, was part of a group called the Mothers of the Fallen, which was made up of women from dozens of cultures who had either been rescued from sexual slavery or had escaped. The main organization was focused on healing, helping, re-educating, and working with political groups to try and stop those kinds of practices, and they were making inroads, though it was an uphill battle.
The slave trade in the 21st century was far bigger than it ever was in the pre-Civil War days. It was a trillion-dollar global market, which is why the Mothers of the Fallen formed ArcLight, their highly militant and extremely proactive response to the ongoing threats. A very smart, very scary woman who went by the code name of Lilith ran ArcLight. Any stories you may have seen on the internet conspiracy websites about their body count is seriously underestimated. I took Almasi's cell phone from my pocket and asked the team tech guy, Jackpot, aka Andrea, for an uplink. He handed me a small device about the size of a postage stamp and thick as three stacked quarters. It had a shape-adaptive plug, and I socketed it into the charging port on the cell. Immediately, tiny green lights flicked on along one side of the device. I tapped my earbud. Bug, sending a data stream from Almasi's phone. I need everything that's on it. Call logs, IMs, and emails. The works. On it, was the quick reply. I set the phone down, rubbed my eyes, and followed the smell of coffee into the kitchen. My team sat around the table, and I joined them, each of us letting the adrenaline work its way out of our system. Processing the details happens by degrees, and sometimes the best clarity comes from sitting down like ordinary folks to have coffee and eggs and toast. Returning to the real world, or at least our version of it. Havoc was the first of three strike teams in the newly formed Rogue Team International, RTI for short. 7 months ago, I worked for the U.S. government as part of the Department of Military Sciences, but increasing red tape and runaway political party politics had made it impossible for us to function at top speed, which sucked, because we were formed for exactly the opposite. We were created to serve as an ultra-rapid response spec ops group, a mix of science geeks and first-chair shooters. I'd run Echo Team for the DMS, and we'd scored a lot of wins against the bad guys, but then started tripping over the red tape. So, our boss, Mr. Church, pulled the plug, shut the DMS down, and took a core of the old guard with him to start Rogue Team International. We were about a tenth the size of the DMS, but RTI had the advantage of picking our own cases and moving fast with no oversight but our own. We work in harmony with the brighter lights in the UN, but we're in no way answerable to them. We can pivot and shoot without anything slowing us down. It felt a bit odd to roll out with a new team name and new combat call signs for all of us. I'd been cowboy for years, now I was outlaw. That handle was a bit of a joke because on my last official DMS case, I'd been hunted as a felon by the Secret Service. They tried to arrest me several times and were spectacularly unsuccessful. Even though the attempted arrests had proved to be illegal, the agents could have handled it with class and professional courtesy. They did not. Instead, they came at me in ways that pushed all of my bad buttons. I wondered how they were coming along with their physical therapy. Didn't cry a bunch of tears over anything I did because they dealt the play. Now I was an international man of mystery. Or something. Now I was outlaw in spirit as well as name. The other teams were also in gear, though not running a shooting op. Chaos was involved in a series of training exercises in the Afghan hills with some spooky cats from the SAS and Mossad. Bedlam team was in Norway in one of those unofficial, official gigs tied to D9, the denuclearization agreement summit with the United States, Russia, France, China, the UK, Pakistan, India, Israel, and North Korea. Officially, Bedlam had no status and was not actually there. No paperwork, no designation, nothing. Unofficially, a friend of Church's in the U.S. State Department and another chum working in some unnamed department in the Norwegian government both asked Church for a little help. Not actually security, but boots covertly on the ground in case something weird happened. I was glad I didn't get that gig because it sounds like a yawn fest. Instead, I was having fun in Syria. The Jacobson gig was Havoc Team's fifth field op, and it was the first where we'd had to pull triggers. The previous four outings were a cross between useful scut work and trial runs. I looked around at my crew. Apart from Top and Bunny, we had two new players. Seated in the corner was Andrea, a guy who could best be described as usefully nondescript. He was medium height, medium build, had medium brown hair and medium brown eyes, and a face you'd forget 2 minutes after you met him. His full name was Andrea Bianchi, and he went by the call sign of Jackpot because he could not pass a game of chance without betting his paycheck. Craps, poker, arm wrestling, horses, you name it. Andrea was on loan to us from the Gruppo di Intervento Speciale, an elite division of Italy's Carabinieri, which was a branch of their armed forces responsible for both military and civil policing. The GIS were tough sons of bitches, and although he didn't look it, Andrea was our utility infielder. He could rig a bomb, cut a throat, or pick a lock with equal nonchalance. He was also able to drive or fly anything with a motor. The person sitting to my right was his polar opposite. I didn't know her real name, but her Arclight code name was Belle, short for La Belle Dame Sans Merci. In combat, she was Mother Mercy, a joke that none of her enemies found funny. Belle was a Muslim woman from Mauritania whose face and body were heavily scarred from religious torture. She had worse scars than the ones we could all see, because when she was 2 years younger than Astrid, she had been subjected to female genital mutilation. It's a common practice in Mauritania, and all the more barbaric for that. Her sister had died from infections resulting from the same treatment. Belle had been severely beaten many times for trying to escape. Probably worse things had been done to her because there are a lot of fucking asshole men who treat women with no flicker of mercy or humanity. Which is why Arclight sent a team in to bust up a large camp where FGM was carried out. During the battle, Belle picked up a rifle and began killing the doctors and soldiers. She'd never touched a gun before, but had seen them used enough times to understand. The story I got was that she killed 18 men that day. No mercy at all, but then again, those men did not deserve any. I don't see myself shedding any tears for them either. Lilith recruited her into Arclight and spent 2 years turning her into a very precise weapon. Understand, Belle could have opted out and been sent to one of the camps run by the Mothers of the Fallen, where women and girls are given medical treatment, education, training, and protection. That wasn't for Belle. She had a war to fight and, as it turned out, had natural gifts. Good with hands, feet, and knives, but with a gun? Any kind of gun. She was the angel of death. Lilith's daughter, Violin, oversaw Belle's training as a sniper. When she exceeded even Violin's prodigious skills, Violin gave her that nickname, La Belle Dame Sans Merci, the beautiful lady without mercy. Lilith asked Belle if she wanted to join Havoc Team. It was a tough offer, too, because she would be the only woman on our team. There were two women on Chaos Team and one on Bedlam, but Belle said that Havoc would be fine. The first day we were all on the firing range, she put a grouping of 6 shots into the groin of a paper target at 2,000 yards. That's world class and, as personal statements go, eloquent. Top, who was overseeing the range practice, put the end of a wooden matchstick between his teeth and chewed it from one corner of his mouth to the other.
She'll do right fine.
For him, that was the highest possible praise. She brings baggage, I said. He gave me a long, amused, fatherly look.
Then you two should get along fine, because let's face it, you got enough baggage your own self to open a luggage store.
It wasn't said as a criticism, I said. He nodded. We had room for more players on Havoc, but for now the 5 of us were a team. Still had some kinks to work out, but when we heard Astrid and her father talking in the other room, we looked at each other, shared nods, shared smiles. It was good to be back in the game. Chapter 8. Transcript of One World, Two Sides with Jillian Bakshi and Dr. Andy Ming, hosted by Mitch Greenfield, Bloomberg Television.
Greenfield. And we're back. We're talking with Jillian Bakshi, senior Pacific trade correspondent for Forbes, and Dr. Andy Ming, best-selling author of the book One Korea. Jillian, before the break, you were telling us about the economic impact of a unified Korea. Bakshi.
Yes, Mitch. It's not as simple as erasing lines on a map or tearing down the guard posts on either side of the DMZ. The Korean War is not over. It never actually ended. There has been a truce, and not a comfortable one, since 1953, and in the time since then, North and South Korea have become vastly different countries.
Greenfield. Different in what way? Politically, or Bakshi?
In every way.
Ming.
Agreed.
Greenfield.
How so?
Bakshi.
Well, South Korea is now the 11th biggest economy, boasting some of the world's top engineering and tech firms. While at the same time, North Korea is a largely agricultural culture with a GDP less than 1% of the South. That puts them on completely uneven footing with little chance of an even integration. It's not like metropolitan New Yorkers and farmers in the American Corn Belt. The education alone is vastly different. The access to news, freedom of action, and 10,000 other things are different. It would be closer in some ways to comparing 21st century America to early 17th century farmsteads.
Greenfield.
You've said much the same in your book, Dr. Ming.
Ming.
To a degree. Look, my father is Chinese and my mother is Korean. I've visited North and South Korea a number of times and have spoken about reunification. I don't advocate a simple erasure of borders, though, and partly for the reasons Ms. Bakshi has discussed. It runs deeper than that, and I'm not just talking about the extreme differences in political ideology. The cultural differences have created two kinds of Koreans. Think about it. On one hand, you have the farmers in the north, many of whom are not allowed education beyond a certain point and who have been spoon-fed party rhetoric for so many years that they accept it as the only possible truth. On the other, you have the explosive growth of the culture in the south, which is driven by such incredible tech growth that students often study for 10, 12, or even 16 hours a day so they can vie for access to the three big universities. At the same time, there is a popular culture that dominates everything. You have K-pop, runaway fashion trends, webcomics, apps for everything, 24-hour video game saloons, fetish for comics and cosplay. It's called the K-wave, but it's more of a tsunami. Tell me, if you were born and raised in the North, how would you ever assimilate into something like that?
Bakshi.
Much of that is good. It puts the South on the leading edge of cultural and technological change.
Ming.
Yes, but at a price.
The K-wave, as it's called, had plenty of problems. I mentioned the hours students study, but this is also reflected in the sometimes brutal hours people work at their jobs. The fashion and cosplay culture has resulted in the highest rate of cosmetic surgery in the world, not just as an attempt at beautification, but to become the characters in pop culture. And we also see one of the highest suicide rates in the world.
Bakshi. And there are strong movements within the government, the education system, and elsewhere in the South that are working to address these things.
Ming. I'm delighted to hear it, but I brought those things up as a way of putting reunification in the lens. Merging such disparate cultures is noble in theory. But in practice, you'd have what are essentially pre-industrial peasants colliding culturally with people way out on the chaotic edge of social change, pop culture brand addiction, and a dangerous one-upmanship of social acceptance.
Bakshi. Are you saying reunification is impossible?
Ming. I'm saying it's improbable. Look, we know from observing North Korean defectors that there is a real struggle for them to assimilate into South Korean, and by some extension, Western, culture. The culture shock causes depression. Very often they are unable to find work because they aren't trained in what the South needs of its workforce.
There are many cases of defectors returned to the North.
Bakshi. That can be addressed, though, if the South instituted some kind of affirmative action program that would give North Koreans the chance to learn the skills, more opportunities would open up.
Ming. Sure, and you would have a lot of pushback, just as you had in America during its race or gender-based affirmative action programs.
Bakshi. Those programs did a lot of good.
Ming. Sure, but I've never seen an affirmative action program that was as well-written and flexible as it needs to be to keep pace with cultural changes. The South's culture pivots on a dime, so any social programming would need to be equally flexible, and you'd need a massive PR campaign to sell it to the South and likely to the North.
Bakshi. That's pretty cynical, Andy.
Ming. That's politics, Jillian.
Greenfield.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with the topic of Korean reunification and focus on the military and political ramifications. Stay tuned.
Chapter 9. Hotel Helsten, Lundmakargatan 68, Stockholm, Sweden, 5 months ago.
I've never done this before, he said.
Eve had expected the man to say this. It was always in the script, no matter how improvised the other details were. She had the tab of his zipper between her thumb and forefinger. She leaned forward another inch so that her breath was hot on his cheek, his ear.
Do you want me to stop?
No, he said, almost a gasp, because they both knew he didn't want her to stop.
It's just that I...
She simultaneously bit his earlobe in a way that disrupted any attempt at coherent speech while at the same time slowly pulling his zipper down. His cock, hard for an hour already, bulged into the opening. Her fingers spread the lips of his fly and closed around his shaft. He wore cotton boxers and she worked her hand along his length. He hissed and arched his back and gasped and was hers. Seduction was easy for her. She had the body for it, the face for it, and the heart for it. Eve was 30 and looked 20. 5'3", 126 pounds of curves over useful muscle. The best cosmetic nips and tucks in the world, which meant the effect was obvious, but none of the surgery was. Her hair, top and bottom, was currently a rich auburn. She had not, of course, managed to seduce everyone she targeted, but her success rate gave her a glow of pride. 83% of men, 77% of women. This man was an easy mark. They kissed deeply, and she knew how to school him into being better at it without making it seem like she was superior. That was a subtle tactic, and it always worked. It empowered men like this, and women too. They would think they were really good at this, and her obvious reactions would push them closer and closer into commission. She let the kissing build a little, and then she broke contact, bent down, and took him in her mouth while unbuckling his belt and pulling his pants off. His boxers came next. It was a bit awkward because he was pawing at her, trying to get to her breasts. She pulled up her blouse and bra and let him play while she continued to blow him.
Oh, God! Oh, God,
he moaned, making it a litany, a familiar one. Eve was excellent at gauging how close a man was to orgasm, and before things got too far, she straightened, pulled her blouse off, reached under her skirt, and pulled down her thong, snatching a condom from the bedside table.
No,
he protested, but she gave him a wicked smile.
It's the wrong time of the month for me. I don't want to get pregnant. Besides, they're ultra-thin. You'll feel everything. I can promise you that.
She rolled the condom over his erection and then climbed atop him, reaching down to guide him into her. He gasped like a cracked steam pipe, and Eve moaned too. She was very wet and very excited and began riding him, slowly and deeply at first, telling him how hard he was, how big, how good. He had his hands on her breasts, pulling and pinching her nipples, and she braced on his stomach to give her good control over what her hips did. She made sure to make a lot of noise because even though Adam was very quiet, she didn't want to spoil the moment. She was enjoying herself and didn't want the mark to be distracted until she had what she needed from him.
God, she cried. Fuck me harder.
He did. The man was so close now that she knew she could make him come right away if she wanted, but she was selfish. Her own orgasm was poised there, waiting for her, and she set the rhythm that worked best for her. It rose up like a dark wave, chasing all of the light from her mind, sending her into a special, beautiful place of burning shadows, black with hints of fiery red.
Fuck!
She cried as she came, and her internal muscles clenched him, and that pulled the man up to the edge of the cliff and shoved him over. He came so hard that his back arched and shudders rippled through his body. He screamed louder than she did, and at a higher register, and then grabbed her hips, braced his feet, and lifted her off the bed, thrusting with hard, grunting, powerful attacks of his hips. And then he collapsed back, sweat glistening on his face and throat, as if he'd run up 10 flights of stairs. His eyes were glazed and unfocused, and aftershocks trembled in his groin and thighs. Eve bent and kissed him as she lifted her hips so that his cock, already growing flaccid, slipped out of her. She reached back and slid the condom off of him, pinching it closed so as not to spill a drop.
Thank you,
she whispered as she looked at the bulging receptacle end of the condom.
Wow. You came a lot. You must have really needed this. It's been a while, he gasped.
So, said Adam as he stepped out of the wardrobe, was it good for you? The man screeched in surprise, shoving Eve away and clawing a sheet in front of his crotch.
What the fuck is this?
Adam raised the pistol. It was a Bulgarian Makarov loaded with 380 ACP rounds and fitted with a sound suppressor.
This, he said, is you getting fucked. Again,
corrected Eve.
Again, agreed Adam.
What do you want? Demanded the man. My wallet's in my...
Adam sat down on the edge of the bed and placed the barrel of the pistol against the tip of the man's nose.
Shh, he said gently. Now isn't the time for you to get loud.
Nope.
Silence is golden.
The man looked cross-eyed at the gun.
Please. I have a wife. I have kids.
We know,
said Eve.
Elsa is at work. Don't you love how her office is decorated? All those photos of the kids. So cute.
Very cute, said Adam.
And as for the girls, who picked out Freya's outfit today? That unicorn top? She's the envy of everyone in daycare, and Maya, well, she's always popular. She's so pretty she could wear a burlap sack and the boys would still fall in love. Especially now that she's so grown up. C-cup, I think. Busty for a 13-year-old.
As Eve spoke, the man's face drained of all blood, all color, leaving his skin gray and waxy. His mouth moved, forming disconnected words but not making any sound. Then he managed to push out a single word.
Please.
So loaded with horror, with need, that it sounded as if it was scraped from the rawness of his throat. Adam moved the pistol, tapping the man's upper lip, his chin, his chest, his navel, and then his scrotum. With each tap, he said, "Boop." It made Eve giggle.
Don't hurt my family.
Wheezed the man.
For the love of God, please don't hurt them.
Adam used the barrel to lift the sheet away from the man's flaccid penis.
Impressive junk you got there.
Not bad,
said Eve as she bent and kissed Adam on the mouth.
Yours is bigger.
Don't care.
Me neither.
What do you want?
Demanded the man.
Oh, said Adam. We want a lot. We want more than you're going to want to give, but we don't want to turn this into a long discussion, and I'm pretty sure you don't want either of us to have to insist that you cooperate. You're a smart man, Mr. Lingmurth, so you can probably imagine some of the things we could do to make you help us.
No,
Don't hurt them.
Hurt is a relative term, said Adam. He pulled a cell phone out of his pocket and handed it to Eve, who punched in the security code and pulled up an image. She showed it to Ronald Lingmurth. The picture was a 5-year-old mixed-race girl, medium brown skin, paler curly hair, blue eyes.
You know this kid, right?
said Eve. Lingmurth did not want to answer.
Sure you do, said Adam.
Tuva Johansson. She has playdates with Freya twice a week, sometimes more. Best friends are such a precious thing. He leaned close and smiled like a wolf.
I bet Freya would be absolutely devastated if Tuva wound up raped and murdered. Bet she'd be destroyed when the forensics techs swabbed your semen out of that little girl's mouth and ass and...
Lingmurth screamed and lunged for the condom Eve still held. Eve twisted away and Adam hooked his left fist into the naked man's balls with terrible force. Lingmurth emitted an ultrasonic shriek and his whole body convulsed into a tight knot of agony. Adam grabbed a fistful of Lingmurth's hair and forced his head back, emphasizing this by pressing the silencer hard up under the soft palate.
Shh,
he said again, leaning on it more now, making it a threat. Things became suddenly very still. Lingmurth lay there, barely breathing, eyes wide and trapped, heart pounding. Eve got off the bed, crossed the room to the wardrobe, and removed a small biological specimen carrier. When she opened it, tendrils of dry ice vapor curled out like snakes. She unscrewed a vial, upended the condom, and squeezed all the semen out. She sealed the vial, closed the container, went into the bathroom, flushed the condom, and then returned to the bedroom with a towel, which she used to pat her vagina dry.
You have a choice, said Adam. Well, three choices. Choice A is you fuck with us and the cops find Tuva's body with your jism and DNA all over her. You go to prison and your family is destroyed forever. Wait, wait, don't say anything yet. Just listen. Good boy. Choice B is that you try some kind of stunt, like feeding us the wrong information in the hopes that we'll get caught, or going straight to the police to try and warn them in time to prevent our people from doing that to Maya or Freya. What's the consequence for that? Well, it wouldn't be Tuva's pussy they swab your DNA out of. You have three pussies at home, let's not forget.
Lingmurth's face had gone from gray to green and was now an awful purple.
Or, said Adam, you go for what's behind door number three.
You're mixing a metaphor, I think,
said Eve. Adam blew her a raspberry.
Choice C, he said, is you help us without any games, without trying any hinky shit at all. And then the only people who ever get hurt are people you never heard of. People you've never met. People who don't mean a fucking thing to you. People who, even if you hear about what happens to them, won't be real to you because they belong to a whole other part of the world.
The cell phone rang. Eve answered, listened, said,
Got it, Daddy.
She fetched the biological transport box, took it to the door, opened it, and handed it to someone outside. Lingmurth could not see who it was, but had the sense that it was a man. Whoever Daddy was. Then Eve closed and locked the door. Adam removed the gun from Lingmurth's chin.
Get up, he said.
Don't kill me,
cried Lingmurth.
Get up, right now.
The man did, and Adam had him sit in the heavy wooden armchair across the room. He fished plastic zip ties from his pocket and held the pistol, as Eve used the ties to secure Lingmurth's wrists and ankles to the arms and legs of the chair. Adam produced a ball gag, and Eve fitted that into place as well. Then Adam set the gun down on the nightstand and began to undress.
We're going to give you a few minutes to think through your three choices, he said as he stepped out of his dark trousers.
He was lean and muscular and looked like he could be Eve's brother. They both had natural, pale blonde hair and blue eyes. When Adam dropped his underwear, it was obvious he was fully erect.
Eve came over to him and they stood, kissing, hands roving hungrily over each other. Then they tumbled onto the bed and for the next 35 minutes they made love with tenderness and passion. Eve came twice, once when he went down on her and then again with Adam as they coupled on the sweaty sheets. Adam did not use a condom. The only words spoken were a single sharp rebuke when Eve looked over and saw that Lingmurth had his eyes squeezed shut.
"Open your eyes, motherfucker!"
she snarled in a voice that was suddenly inhuman.
"Watch us or I'll do things to your children that will ruin you."
Then she turned back to Adam and kissed him sweetly, and they made love. Option C was always the winner. That's what Daddy had taught them, and Daddy was always right. Chapter 10. In Flight, over the Mediterranean Sea. Bug bing-bonged in my ear. "Outlaw," he said, "we're getting a ton of stuff off that cell phone. It was coded and all, but, well, this is me. Stop gloating and tell me what you found." "Almasi was not just working for Assad," said Bug. "He was the point man to oversee the acquisition of a whole bunch of different biological and chemical agents, which he's been selling to various clients. The Jacobson stuff was only part of it. Most of it is referred to by code names or numbers, but there are some messages that name the vendor for some of it." "You actually got a name?" "I do," he said, "and you're not going to like it." "Bug, would you like a long list of all the things I don't like?" Instead of answering, he gave me the name. "Kuga," he said. He was right. I didn't like it one damn bit. I closed my eyes and considered banging my head against the wall. "How sure are you?"
"Very,"
said Bug. "The name is actually in a few of the messages we've already decoded. I have the guys working on the rest. They use a random encryption algorithm, and I don't care if they used a Ninja Turtles secret decoder ring. I need everything else you can find on Kuga. Everything, Bug." There was a pause, then Bug said, "Look, Joe, don't get your hopes up too much. We've been round and round with trying to ID Kuga. Every time we get a whiff, he's gone." "Christmas is coming," I said. "Try and spread a little fucking cheer, okay?" His sigh was long and eloquent, and he ended the call. I was in a comfortable leather seat on a very expensive Cessna Citation X private jet. The rest of Havoc were sprawled asleep in their chairs. Bunny had earphones on, but he'd shifted in his sleep and the left cup was askew, and I could hear the faint strains of Christmas music. "I'll Be Home for Christmas," the Elvis version. The song was always a sad one for me because I'd spent so many Christmases away from my dad and my brother Sean and his family. We all had, and the music, coupled with the after-action blues, painted the moment in shades of melancholy. My big white combat shepherd Ghost was aboard, too. He hadn't come on the last part of the rescue mission, but since we didn't know if there was going to be mission creep, things changing from what we thought and hoped was going to happen, I'd brought him to Syria with me. Mostly, he sulked, pooped, ate too many treats, and slept. I watched his ribs rise and fall, and saw a leg occasionally twitch as he dreamed his doggy dreams. The plane was silent as a tomb, and I was wide awake. "Kuga," I said quietly. "Fuck. Kuga. Jeez. If the devil took human form, he would be Kuga." And yes, it was only a code name. It was a Bosnian word that meant plague, so you can figure it wasn't his actual surname unless he was born into the unluckiest family in history. Unfortunately, it was the most common of his many aliases that we had. Kuga. He had a bunch of other nicknames, too. But the one that always hit me was the one hung on him by Contre-Admiral Laurent Isnard, head of the Commandement des Opérations Spéciales, France's Special Operations Command. He always referred to Kuga as the Concierge de l'Enfer, Hell's Concierge. "Yeah, fair enough. If you wanted financing to hire a private army to overthrow an inconvenient African tribal government on mineral-rich land, Kuga could arrange it. If you needed canisters of VX nerve gas to fire into a crowd of worshippers on a holy day, call Kuga. And it did not seem to matter if the worshippers were praying to Allah, Buddha, Shiva, or Jesus. If you wanted some polonium-210 to assassinate a government official, Kuga's your guy. And his name pops up all over the place. Africa, the Middle East, Southeast Asia, among the cartels, and even among some of the mouth-breathing, hard, alt-right, neo-Nazi assholes in America. He's never the delivery boy. As far as we can tell, he's never gotten blood on his own hands. But because of the concierge services he provides, he could fill about a dozen graveyards. And I am likely underestimating that number. Kuga is the Professor Moriarty of international weapons smuggling. He's the force behind half the dirty deals on 7 continents. He's like an evil spirit in the overlapping worlds of international politics, terrorism, and intelligence. I'd first started hearing that name 4 years ago, early on in my career as a DMS shooter. Like Moriarty, there is no actual proof that he even exists. One theory is that Kuga is the name for a team. Another is that there is no Kuga at all, but that the name is adopted as a reusable stage name for people who do what he does. The Alan Smithy of the terrorism world, except that he doesn't direct bad movies, but instead causes very bad things to happen. He came out of the DMS radar some years back when his name showed up in a few heavily encrypted messages being passed to Otto Wirth, the psychotic aide to Cyrus Jacoby, one of the most dangerous and vile real-world mad scientists we've ever encountered. In those messages, it appeared that Kuga was the source of stolen clinical samples of exotic strains of sickle cell anemia and Tay-Sachs disease that were then used to create ethnic-specific bioweapons. Even with our mind-reader computer system, we found nothing beyond his mention in those emails. Then his name popped up in connection with genetically modified Ebola samples used by a terrorist organization called the Seven Kings. And again, when a bizarre new strain of ultra-fast-onset rabies was used by Zephyr Bain to try and dramatically reduce the overall human population as a way of ensuring the survival of the rest. Kuga. Here, there, and nowhere at all. Even though the DMS caught and killed the bad guys running,